Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, we are going to do part one of a two-part series focused on the mind-gut connection in spondyloarthritis. Our guest for these two episodes is Dr. Antonio Repelet. She is a licensed clinical psychologist and certified school psychologist in multiple states. She earned her doctorate from Farley Dickinson University, where her dissertation focused on the mind-body connection and specifically how chronic medical conditions affect self-concept and academic performance. She's recognized for her warm, compassionate, and creative approach in her work with children, teens, and adults, incorporating personalized, engaged methods to build resilience and empower patients through collaborative partnership-based care. She has advanced training across a wide range of therapeutic modalities, including clinical hypnosis, CBT, ACT, psychodynamic therapy, somatic approaches, and more. In her role as a school psychologist, she supports students with gastrointestinal and other chronic health conditions by collaborating with schools to develop tailored accommodations. She helps them overcome emotional, academic, and occupational challenges, and her holistic framework blends clinical care with advocacy, nutrition guidance, stress management, and psychoeducation, emphasizing the critical link between mental and physical well-being. She treats a broad spectrum of concerns, including GI disorders, health anxiety, chronic pain, eating disorders, insomnia, medical trauma, developmental disorders, ADHD, OCD, anxiety, depression, grief, and performance anxiety. Today, we're going to talk about rethinking chronic pain through a psychological lens. So I'm very excited to welcome you, Dr. Repelet. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm great. How are you?
Good. I'm excited about this one for our listeners, because we often talk about gut, and we talk a lot about the mind connection, not always mind gut, if you will. Can you tell us a little bit about how you are working with patients with chronic health conditions like spondyloarthritis, and kind of your journey and how you got here?
Sure, sure. And please feel free to call me Antonia.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here. So I work at a practice, a group practice. We're fully virtual. So we're kind of all spread out throughout the country, which is really nice. We can see patients from all 50 states amongst us. And so we're called GI Psychology for a reason. We specialize in that intersection of mental health and chronic illness, with a particular focus on DGBIs, or disorders of gut-brain interaction, so things like IBS or functional nausea, as well as things, autoimmune conditions like inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, and certainly other chronic health conditions like arthritis, as well as things like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and POTS, chronic pain, and things of that nature. And so, as you mentioned, myself and the other clinicians at GI Psychology, we really love to integrate evidence-based treatment like CBT that are condition-specific, gut-directed hypnotherapy or clinical hypnosis, and certainly trauma-informed care as well, to really focus on the whole person, so their physical, emotional, behavioral, social challenges, whatever that might be, in regard to that health condition that they're experiencing and living with. And so that's a little bit more about me and what I do and what we do at GI Psychology as a whole, but really just aiming to help patients feel safer in their bodies, because as I'm sure that you understand, it's really, really challenging. It's such a long journey of grief and of acceptance and all of the things when we are living with chronic health conditions. So really helping individuals regain that safety in their body, that trust in their body, confidence in managing symptoms, and really reclaiming that sense of agency over their health.
So I'm going to take you off track for a sec.
Yeah.
How did you get it? Why did you get into this work?
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with IBD, Crohn's disease, specifically when I was 9 years old. So it's been quite a journey over 20 years. And, you know, because of that, I went through most major life stages, right? Like a majority of my youth and adolescence and young adulthood, navigating a chronic health condition. So I had an interesting, experience, to say the least, of just one, navigating those developmental stages is difficult in a lot of ways without a chronic health issue, of course. And so with living with something like Crohn's that was very debilitating, especially early on, I had a really interesting experience of kind of navigating those different, parts of life with Crohn's disease, and really experiencing the impact that had on everything, on my social life, on my romantic life when I was starting to date, educationally and professionally. I should back up a little bit. I first started my career working in schools as a school psychologist, and really what led me there, as it pertained to my health journey, was seeing how little the school systems that I was a part of were able to support me or really understand what I was going through, and therefore weren't really providing me with the resources that I needed to thrive, as well as my parents with those resources. And so I struggled pretty significantly with learning and a lot of other areas in terms of school. And so that really drove my passion towards school psychology and working with children and teens in the school systems, as well as the entire system, right? Teachers, other school staff members, parents, guardians, et cetera. And then I recognized that I really wanted to take a deeper dive into clinical work to be able to support individuals on a more individual level and have a little bit more, I don't want to say a little bit more, influence, but certainly when you're working in a clinical space, there's a lot more that you can kind of choose from, as opposed to a school psychologist. You're working in a larger system. And so I wanted to have a little bit more training and specialization into working with individuals with chronic health issues across the lifespan. So I expanded my work and work with adults now as well, which has been really great. And that's kind of what led me to that clinical space. And as most of us with chronic health issues know, usually, especially autoimmune conditions, they like to come in pairs or even more so. So unfortunately, right, I developed some other chronic health conditions. Most recently, over the last 6 months, I was diagnosed with psoriatic arthritis specifically. And that has been really challenging. I'm still dealing with a flare as we speak. And so I'm certainly now understanding from not only a professional perspective, but also a personal perspective, how challenging it is to live with multiple chronic health issues, and really recognizing how they can play a role and can certainly not only co-occur, but kind of impact one another. And so that's why I'm here.
No, thank you for that. I had no idea the answer, so I'm glad I asked. And I appreciate you sharing. Psoriatic arthritis falls under our sort of the whole spondyloarthritis, and and Crohn's is a close cousin, right?
Yep.
So, one of the things I think is interesting is you've studied a lot of the gut-brain axis, and that's forward in your work. For the people who might not be familiar, can you explain a little bit more about it and why it's important in understanding pain and chronic GI issues?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the way that I like to describe it is really that gut-brain axis What's happening there is we have this kind of bi-directional communication network between our gut and our brains, almost as if we actually have a second brain in our gut. And that involves our central and our enteric nervous system. So essentially through things like nerves, hormones, and immune pathways, that is a system that is allowing that brain and gut to quote unquote, talk to each other or communicate. So that can help us in a lot of ways with things like, regulating everything from hunger and fullness to pain and stress responses and immune reactions, almost like when we're kind of fighting off a virus. And that relationship, why it's so important for us to understand it and for us to educate our patients and others into understanding, is that it helps us really explain why stress and anxiety, depression, right, all of those kind of unwanted, uncomfortable emotions can then worsen our GI symptoms and vice versa, right? So, and why, inflammation or irritation to that point in our gut can then affect and influence our mood, focus, sleep, et cetera. So things like DGBIs IBS is falls under that category of a disorder of the gut-brain interaction. So things like IBS or other DGBIs especially, that communication can so easily become dysregulated because of that functional component, leading to things like visceral hypersensitivity, which is another thing that I talk often about. So that's essentially when our gut feels things like pain and discomfort more easily. And then as well, things like hypervigilance, so increased attention to, and then that amplification of bodily sensations. So with those functional disorders like IBS, where we're not necessarily seeing any structural damage, like in things like IBD, along with chronic health issues as well, can then drive that persistence of pain and discomfort in the digestive system and just in terms of our mental health. So when we really understand that dynamic, it kind of helps us understand and our patients understand how to really treat and improve that communication between the brain and the body, and gives us that more compassionate kind of lens and approach to treating those chronic health conditions and distress.
I love that. They should start pairing GI docs with you.
Fortunately, they are. I'm sorry, my headphones are giving me trouble.
You're okay.
Fortunately, they are. So I'm a gastropsychologist. That's my specialty. And there aren't as many of us as we'd like there to be. But we are out there. And we are now seeing over the years more major hospital systems, IBD centers as another example, having GI psychologists, and in other cases too, outside of just like GI conditions, just psychologists on staff, which is amazing. We certainly have, a long way to go still, as is most things in our field, but we are out there and we want to help and we want to get the word out about what we do, because a lot of people don't know about us. So, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. So clinically, can you talk a little bit about mental health, stress, anxiety, depression, how those can impact both GI and musculoskeletal symptoms?
Absolutely. Yeah. So things like stress and anxiety, and certainly sadness and depression as well, we know from research, and I'm sure we and our listeners out there, yeah, your listeners, I should say, know personally that, we know that there is this connection of, because that gut-brain access that I just explained, that we know that it can, those uncomfortable emotions can certainly amplify both our gut and our joints. So essentially when we're in a chronic state of stress, what's happening then is our body is kind of flooded with these inflammatory signals. And what happens then? Well, our muscles tend to tense, or our digestion will slow down or becomes erratic and on the other end of the spectrum. And therefore our pain sensitivity is going to amplify or increase. And so what I pretty much day in and day out see with patients, regardless of exactly what chronic health condition they're presenting with, is they're kind of caught in this negative feedback loop, is what we call it. where our physical symptoms are then increasing our emotional distress, which is then worsening those physical symptoms. And so that's why mental health support can really help to interrupt that cycle, because we can then directly target the nervous system and that nervous system activation, and therefore those cognitive responses to our sensations in the body.
Yeah, it's you're probably describing 80% of the listener base, like everyone that we talk to. But I think you probably were the same way, right? Like you don't feel good. You get everything's okay, but you know not everything's okay, but no one's quite diagnosed it. Oh, and yeah. It's just, and I mean that I've talked to people, and your experience doesn't sound too distant maybe, but it can be decades of this.
Oh, yeah.
Now you're growing, I'm assuming you're continuing to grow it. So I think that, you know, we, in thinking about some of the questions, it leads to like, how does chronic pain impacts the quality of our lives, profoundly in some cases. And is there like specific things that influence the experience of the chronic pain symptoms? Is it neurotransmitters? Is it what's happening in our bodies?
Yeah. So many different things. So in cases, in chronic conditions, you know, like SPA, and certainly also IBD, since they're, you know, pretty closely connected and often seen together, inflammation in our joints, inflammation in our gut, in our bodies, we know, can then lead to and contribute to even more broader systemic inflammation elsewhere. But even just beyond that, you know, potential structural damage or immune activity, how our brains experience pain on an individual level, so how a person really experiences pain, is shaped by that person's brain's filtering system, so to speak. So, you know, we also know that, let's say, individuals that have a history of trauma, or have learned over time because of their environment, let's say, or maybe past flares, or have had some difficulties with coping, over time, what happens is that certainly can lead to further trauma in the body. And then that, therefore, will lead to that sensitization. So where the nervous system is essentially becoming more reactive to input than it needs to. And to kind of circle back for a second, when I mentioned visceral hypersensitivity earlier, where kind of our sensations from internal organs like our gut and our skin are amplified and then perceived as more intense or uncomfortable or threatening because of that visceral hypersensitivity and that past trauma to the body or to the brain or both. And so essentially, dysregulation of that gut-brain access is not only going to contribute to hypersensitivity, but then that misinterpretation of those signals in the brain and the body. So that's why we know that in addition to maybe some of the pain and discomfort that we experience from, you know, structural or joint damage, even things like, let's say, you know, we slept a little wonky on our neck, maybe we don't actually have any arthritis in that part of the body, but because we maybe just had an off night with sleep and we maybe were just sleeping a little bit weird, or we woke up on, you know, the bed and not our pillow, right, whatever that looked like, even without maybe structural damage or inflammation in that part of the body, because of everything that kind of came before with having something like SPA or you know, trauma, even emotionally, even that little bit of like tension or discomfort that maybe any of us would experience if we just woke up on the wrong side of the bed, so to speak, because that person has had experience with something like SPA, what's going to happen is that the body can sometimes then interpret that discomfort, but might just be on the milder end, as actually something dangerous or significantly painful. And so that is a really big component of our work at GIP, where we're not even just paying attention to or treating that specific condition. Obviously, that's a big part of our treatment plan, of course, but it's also really how we are then responding to other signals in the body, because it really is all connected. And especially that trauma piece is really important for us to understand.
Yeah, I think about that a lot, the things that show up in people's lives that, you know, and I often think of it as like looking back as like the failure of the systems they've been a part of at times. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. So you're going to show us how to solve this problem. you use CBT a lot, right? And
I do.
So in specifically using CBT, how can you help manage chronic pain or gut symptoms mm-hmm. for people with SPA or other autoimmune?
Yep, definitely. So what's great about CBT or, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, although I think most people have now heard of it so much, which is great. What's great about it is it really helps us recognize how our thoughts and our behaviors can either soothe or intensify our physical symptoms. So I'm speaking at it from the lens of not just what CBT is as a whole, which teaches us, you know, let's say if someone is seeking CBT treatment and they don't have any chronic health issues going on. So we're going to then learn practical skills to, let's say, challenge unhelpful thoughts or pace our activities. But really, when we're using CBT in for individuals with health trauma, chronic health conditions, we're taking those core components of traditional CBT and we're also using, in addition to those core components, we're also kind of overlapping that with more condition-specific CBT. So when we're looking at it through the lens of chronic health issues and using CBT in those cases, because, right, no one's handing us a manual for how to use our brains to cope with these things. And because we know our brains oftentimes are trying a little bit too hard to protect us from pain and discomfort because of that visceral hypersensitivity component from stress and trauma over time, what we're going to do in addition to those traditional components of CBT, like thought challenging or, you know, using relaxation skills, to calm the body, we're also going to specifically help that individual utilize those skills in ways that work for them and for their symptoms and their condition specifically. So for instance, we might take thought challenging a step further. And if someone's telling us that they're experiencing a lot of joint pain on a regular basis, and they're starting to think, you know, this is never going to get better, right? Or maybe they're avoiding all types of movement or social activities because they're worried it's going to amplify those that joint pain or even cause a flare to erupt. What's happening is that we know that physical and emotional suffering is going to grow. So we're going to focus on not only helping them challenge any unhelpful thought patterns, but also things like how to understand what that suffering is doing to them. And not just the physical suffering of that pain itself, but that added layer of fear and isolation and helplessness that comes with it. So we're really going to help them reinterpret those physical sensations and those unhelpful thought patterns with less fear. So if we're thinking, you know, like this is never going to get better, I'm never going to, you know, improve, or I'll never get out of this flare is another example, we're going to start to help that individual learn how to reframe that in a way that's healthier and is going to really set them up for more success in all of those areas of their life. So, you know, as opposed to this is never going to get better, this is never going to improve, I'm so afraid of all of this increased joint pain, we're going to focus on things like, okay, this is a familiar pattern. We know that it comes and we know that it goes. We also know that we've been here before. We know that we can ride this out, even if it's uncomfortable and even if it's hard. And we are going to use these really effective tools to help. Almost as if I often tell patients, like, if this doesn't feel doable for you when you're kind of reframing this in your mind, it's okay to hear my voice until it starts to become and turn into your own voice.
Oh, I like that.
So I often go for, because oftentimes patients will say, like, yeah, well, you know, when I kind of thought of it from the lens that you were sharing it, that, you know, statement with me in, or like hearing your voice, that's what helped. Like, that's great. That's a wonderful first step.
Yeah.
It's going to start sounding like you at some point, I promise. And over time, that kind of shift in that interpretation of those thoughts is going to then reduce our anxiety, so improve that emotional component, and therefore then lower that pain intensity and that physical distress, and then of course improve overall functioning, which is what we're all looking for. But not even just that thought work, but also things like helping them pace daily activities in sustainable ways. We talk a lot about things like spoon theory, which I'm sure that you've heard of. We of course do a lot of work in terms of like relaxation skills and, distress tolerance. So there's a lot that goes into that CBT beyond that traditional, standpoint.
Okay. So they asked me if we could walk through an exercise or an example. So I'm wondering, can we do a mini session?
Yeah, of course.
All right. You have my full, whatever legalese you need. And this is not, we'll call this not medical advice for anyone else but Jill. And to keep lawyers happy. But like, can we talk about, okay, can I give you an issue I'm having trouble managing? And then we unpack it. Okay. One of my biggest, my goal in life is to challenge this disease until I kill it. I have a complete aversion to thinking there is no possible way I could get to a point where I'm like doing things with impact on my joints or jumping and I always go into this like complete like lockdown fear mode when somebody's like, well, do a jumping jack or do a jump rope and I know these things are, for me and my personal condition, these things are probably possible. There's nothing physically that I can find or my rheumatologist has advised that would be limiting, but somehow over years and years of working out and doing stuff, like I just can never jump the 3 inches to get onto the platform or that kind of stuff. And it's like, I have this, and believe me, 10 years ago, I walked like I was walking on eggshells because I thought I was going to break. So I've come through a lot of that, but I think a lot of us have been through that. And my goal is like, how do I keep building up my resilience? Because at 51, I'm finding as I'm getting older, like there's definitely a sweet spot, right? But I think I have this like fear of like really letting my body move.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing. And I know firsthand how challenging that is. So I'm going to walk you through an exercise called the body sensation reframe, because I think this will be really relevant for what we're talking about. So with some of that fear and those fear-based thoughts, right, of like, I can't, if I do, then this will happen, right? What I would say first in this exercise is we want to just kind of pause for a second when we're noticing those thoughts come up, as you just did so beautifully, and think about if there is a way to gently challenge that. So is there an alternative thought that might feel a little bit more realistic, or that might look a little bit more flexible than those absolutes of I can't, or I won't, or if this, then that.
Oh, like a little bit like move towards something rational.
Well, I always hesitate to say that because, yes, sometimes we do have some irrational components to some of these thoughts, right? But when we're working with chronic health issues, it's not all irrational, right? Like structural. So that's just how I practice. I'm hesitant to frame something as irrational when I know it's coming from a place of trauma. So I like to think of it more as like something a little bit more flexible, or maybe even a little bit more realistic. I know I do have this real fear that if I jump, on this platform when I'm doing X workout, right, or if I, pick up that jump rope and start going, that I'm going to damage my body, right? But we also know that, that you, as far as I know, you were able to walk in the room and sit down and start talking to me, right? So your body can move, your body can do things. And from what you just shared, your rheumatologist hasn't put any limits on your exercise or activity level, right?
Except burpees.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. Totally, also, burpees are, I mean, oh gosh.
I think she just doesn't anyway. Like them. But no, it's, you know what? It's a good question. I mean, I'm standing here thinking about like how I would approach other problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, I've been sitting here just like bouncing, if anybody's watching, I'm bouncing up and down because I'm like, well, maybe I can't jump 3 inches today, but I can certainly bounce and get the feel of that.
Yeah. And
structurally figure out like, oh, landing on my heels doesn't hurt as much. And I asked the rational question because I'm a fan of Adler's work, but that's mm-hmm. a whole different episode. Okay. So yeah, I suppose I could reframe it as like baby steps or like mm-hmm. one jump at a time. And I know that when I like, if I get really excited about something, I can jump up and down and it doesn't hurt me.
There you go. And you just did it. You were able to, you actually went 2 steps ahead, which is great. You not only reframed those fear-based thoughts, but you also connected it with some behavioral activation, right? Of like hopping around and also, you know, naming some things that you could maybe try to do that might take you 1 step closer to, let's say, jumping up on that, you know, step or whatever you want to call it. So essentially what we're doing there is we're taking that body sensation reframe. We're paying attention to what it is that those thoughts are telling us that we can't do or that is really causing that fear in terms of movement in this case. We're reframing to something a little bit more flexible and realistic, and we're then pairing that with some type of behavioral activation. So sometimes I'll schedule it with a patient. So, okay, maybe tomorrow you can try to, as an example, maybe just gently hop up and down, and even without, actually not even hop up and down, maybe you're just going to take 5 minutes to just do some heel raises and see how that feels, right? And then maybe if that feels okay, maybe the next day, let's see what would happen if you just hopped up and down on your chair while still seated. We're not actually hopping up too high or right or using like all of our energy or both legs to hop up and down all at once, but we're just going to get that movement again in the body and see how that goes. So we're going to kind of essentially collaborate on some type of behavioral piece here to then reduce avoidance and then increase that confidence and that safety and resiliency that, okay, my body can do these things. And let's say we try something and it doesn't feel great. Also fine. Now we know, right, that maybe we also want to pay attention to not pushing ourselves too far as well. And maybe in the past we did that a lot. And that's why now we're really fearful of engaging with some of these things again, for fear of causing some damage or worsening, let's say, a flare that's already there. So either way, we're getting some really good data and some information back, right? And we're helping ourselves reframe those early sensations and those thoughts in a way that feels more flexible and more realistic for us. And in turn, how did that make you feel in terms of physically, any sensation shift for you after kind of thinking in that more flexible way? What did you notice?
I'm going to tell you what was going through my head, and it's not related to jumping. It's like, maybe I can actually learn to shuffle. Like, I'm afraid of that too. It must be something with my legs and my hips. But no, I think it's also, you said something earlier that I think is really important to remember. And it's like, we don't learn, or I don't learn very quickly. I don't know about other people. But it's that I've been here before.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, if you've done it before and it created a negative outcome, how do you either like, how do you work through that if you want to, because I think I also think this in general, a lot of these diseases, if we can figure out the puzzle, you can like go like game it to the next level to some extent.
Sure.
But it's, yeah, I mean, I feel like it's a silly phobia or whatever I have of it, but I think it's real. And I find myself like working out and I'm like, okay, everybody else is jumping. Why can't I do a jumping jack? Like, there's no reason. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to try it. I'll let you know in episode two.
There you go. And maybe you can, maybe not even just that full jumping jack, but maybe just, you know, using the arms in that way that you would if you were doing a jumping jack, or just doing it in a stepped process. Maybe we're just going to put one leg out to the side and back in, and the other out to the side and back in. There's no jumping involved yet, but we're inching closer, right? And we're checking in with our bodies too, which is another important piece, to see how that feels, right? And really listening to our bodies in a way that comes from a flexible, again, that's an important word that I keep using, that flexible place without judgment. So if we are, let's say, just doing the arm component of a jumping jack, and we're starting to notice that, you know, our wrists are feeling a little tight or tense, like, oh, okay, I'm just going to get curious about that and see why that might be. But if any thoughts kind of come in the mind and are telling me that I need to stop or pause, or I'm going to injure myself, I'm just going to see what could happen if I can pause for a second and maybe take it a step back and, again, go through that motion of reframing what some of those thoughts are telling us, and therefore in framing that sensation. Okay, maybe my wrists are feeling a little bit tight because I haven't done this in so long. But can I breathe through it? Is it painful? Is it so painful that I have to put my arms down? Maybe not. Maybe I can see what feels good and what that next step can look like from a more curious perspective. And it doesn't mean that just because that pain or tightness is there, that a full flare is coming, right? And we can continue to kind of build this hierarchy of manageable activities, or movement in this case, that we can still engage in, even on days where we might have, you know, some discomfort present. And then over time, we can get more comfortable with that movement, and feeling, you know, more emotionally grounded in that process too.
I think that's amazing. I'm still never going to apply any of this to triceps.
That's okay. You get to decide.
I give up every day in the gym. Okay, triceps, really? But I have spondylitis. I can't do triceps.
That's hard. Yeah.
It is hard. That's really interesting. I think this, what did you call it? The hierarchy of manageable activities.
Yes. And that's the important component to what you just mentioned. Like, this is all patient led. So I am not saying, okay, you have to do X, Y, and Z without obviously the patient collaborating with me, right? Like, we are working towards goals that they want to work on. So maybe they do, let's say, want to work on being able to work out their triceps, right? And that is like something that they can, in terms of, you know, what their doctor has told them, they think they can actually do, but they're just really scared of. Like, we're going to take a very slow, gradual, stepped approach to working up to doing, let's say, some of those tricep dips. But I'm certainly not throwing out ideas there that are like not anywhere near where that patient wants to go or what their goals are. Of course, it's very patient led. But yeah, that's, you know, it's not necessarily always about like the pain disappearing. It's really more so about the fear of that pain.
Depression. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're right. Well, you're the expert, so I'm sure you're more right than I am on those things. Okay, we've got a few minutes left before we have to move on, but trauma-informed care, and I'm really curious, and we may want to get into this in episode two a bit also, but how does past trauma affect the gut-brain axis and severity of flares?
Absolutely. So many types of trauma, of course, are you know, applicable here. But, you know, I'll just speak to some of the more common types that we see. So, of course, medical trauma, but certainly developmental trauma as well. So all of that can create this heightened sensitivity, or that visceral hypersensitivity to internal sensations. Because essentially what happens is that gut-brain axis after that trauma has occurred becomes like wired for danger, making both our you know, GI and pain symptoms as one example, more intense. So we notice that then that trauma is leading to that almost like chronic hyperarousal or like shutdown responses, which then in turn disrupts immune function, digestion, pain perception, all the things that, you know, oftentimes our patients want to improve on. So trauma-informed care is so important when you're working really in any type of therapy, but certainly with you know, health psychology or working with individuals with chronic health conditions, because we really want to help that individual reestablish that safety and that trust in their body. So what I use, I use a combination of approaches. So of course we talked about CBT a little bit, but also somatic work. And hopefully we can have some time too to talk about things like clinical hypnosis, which is always really fun to talk about. So a lot of different mind body techniques in addition to those behavioral techniques like CBT or ACT, to help individuals reconnect with their body's safety. So things like using guided imagery or hypnosis, as two examples to kind of rewire how the brain is then interpreting pain signals, because we know that that trauma and therefore that chronic hyperarousal and shutdown responses can certainly play a role in our physical symptoms and therefore in you know, experiencing flares. And so that it's a really important component to integrate here. And there's definitely a lot that we can speak to there. So things like narrative work around medical trauma can be really healing, giving patients like agency and coherent stories that foster resilience rather than things like helplessness, you know, mindfulness and breath work, and hypnosis, you know, are all central also as well to calming our autonomic nervous system and really tapping into that parasympathetic nervous system where we can get that rest. Yeah.
Can you dig into an example on one of those, like the fostering the narrative around like resilience as opposed to helplessness?
Right. Yeah. So we're really taking a gradual and stepped approach to first understanding what their trauma narrative looked like through a variety of means, whether that's, you know, certainly verbally, of course, but if that's not possible, we might talk about different sensations, different colors, shapes, statements, other different kind of snippets of memories from that past trauma, maybe through art, maybe through, you know, just exploring through different types of like breath work or grounding techniques. You know, so we're really just kind of, I'm taking the patient's lead essentially and really being mindful through that compassionate, you know, and trauma-informed lens of just, you know, following their lead and kind of giving them options of ways that they can re-engage with that experience in ways that feel best for them. And certainly, you know, dependent on their developmental level, since I do work in pediatrics as well. And then once I have a kind of a good understanding and the patient has a, you know, possibly better understanding of what that looked like, then we can kind of take a step back and through one, just, you know, giving them some kind of go-to relaxation techniques that they can utilize if through this experience things get feel a little bit uncomfortable in the body. So we might pause, we might do some, you know, guided breath work or some tapping techniques. One of the techniques I really like to use and teach patients to ground themselves is something called the butterfly tapping technique, where we take our hands, we make them into a butterfly, and we just alternate taps on our collarbone, or we can alternate taps on our shoulder blade. We know that there are specific pressure points in our shoulder blades and in our collarbones that when tapping lightly but intentionally, actually will trigger that vagus nerve, which is actually the longest nerve in our body that goes all the way down from our brain stem and down the back. And when we are able to tap into that vagus nerve, we then can calm down that autonomic nervous system and really enhance that parasympathetic or rest and digest nervous system. And so we get that somatic physical relief. So we might pause and do some kind of tapping or, you know, let's say like guided breathing techniques together to really just give ourselves, you know, our bodies the support that it needs as we're doing this trauma-informed work as often as we need to. And then we're just exploring throughout how we can rewrite that traumatic experience in a way that fosters that resilience rather than that helplessness that trauma often, you know, leaves us with. So we definitely don't want to frame that in a way of, okay, we have to talk about like forgiving this person for this or that. So that's certainly not something that we're going to do. We're going to talk about whatever it is that feels good for that person. So maybe we can, let's say, if they were showing us what that traumatic experience and story looked like through a lens of art, maybe we can try to see what that image could look like. If that person could step back into their body in that moment and let's say, you know, share with that provider what it was that made them feel X, Y, or Z way. Or maybe when they were on a really distressing and long and painful call with their insurance because they kept denying their claims, which I know all of us have been through probably more than once, maybe they could then step back into that moment. And now with some of these really wonderful and calming somatic techniques, they could imagine themselves grounding themselves in that moment so that that really long, painful, frustrating call was just a little bit less distressing or painful. So those are just some ways that we can kind of rewrite that history for them, but in a way that, you know, feels compassionate and appropriate for them and whatever it is that they're looking to, you know, obtain from that experience. And so that's just one way, but we can certainly talk about other holistic practices too that can support that gut brain access.
Yeah, I think let's do it. Let's do a FOMO for episode 2, and we'll put it at the top of the discussion. And I think this has been super helpful. And I think, you know, I'm sure there are people who may be non-believers, I guess, if you will, or skeptical about psychological interventions and for symptoms that are purely physical. I think it's something that, like, as we learn more about ourselves, and I'm hoping you would agree. And I always think when we do these episodes, like, it's not something you find on Instagram where like it solves itself overnight, like all like you see happening. Something like there is work to it. It may not be for everybody all the time, but do you have any advice or words of encouragement for someone who might be like navigating all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things I always say to patients, because one of the things I pretty much always hear from patients is that they've been told that their symptoms are all in their head. And that also can then lead to just, you know, all of that medical trauma that I just spoke to, but also just trust in all healthcare, mental healthcare as well, right? So I often will say to patients, even if this isn't something that they specifically mentioned when we're talking about that gut-brain access, that, you know, everything starts in our head. That's where our pain comes from. That's how we interpret pain, right? So our brain is a part of our body. And so our symptoms are a part of our body, and our symptoms are extremely valid and very much real, whether they're coming from a structural place, a functional place, or a mix of both, right? Yeah. It's really what's important is how we are interpreting that pain or that inflammation or whatever that distress is, mood, physical, otherwise. That can really help us get that symptom relief that we're looking for with that compassionate support. So most often I find that individuals are relieved to learn that there are tools even beyond medication that can make a real difference in our daily experiences. So really encouraging patients or listeners, you know, everything is happening up here. So that's one way that I like to just frame this conversation. But even more importantly, in a lot of ways, you're not alone. Managing chronic pain, managing chronic health conditions, managing just, you know, health conditions in general is so hard, and feeling overwhelmed is valid. And how can we not, right? But there's hope, and there are tools. And there are those of us that have lived experiences as well. And we can start with maybe just one small thing. Maybe it's not finding a therapist. Maybe it's just taking some time to just recognize how you're sitting throughout the day, and maybe taking a few minutes just to roll the shoulders back, or to really pay attention to that breath and seeing if you can loosen it a bit, or seeing if you can just take a walk, maybe just downstairs, maybe not even outside yet. That's fine. Or maybe if you're not ready to seek support, like I said, through therapy, maybe you can ask for support in another way. Maybe it's just a matter of starting with, you know, asking, this might sound silly, but, you know, maybe it's just asking your pet if they can stop jumping on you so much when you're trying to rest, right? Like, we can think of silly ways. We can think of gradual ways to, you know, lead us to a place of healing and of resiliency, or strengthening that healing and resiliency, and also recognizing that healing isn't linear. Grief isn't linear, right? And so we're going to have things that wax and wane, but you're allowed to take up space when things are maybe waxing more than waning, right? And ask for care and build a life that supports your body and your well-being.
Oh, I love that. That is a beautiful way to end part one. We will be back soon for part two, but Antonia, thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to speaking again shortly.
Likewise, thank you for having me.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie.
Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.